You're listening to Unplugged Radio,
a podcast in which a trio of longtime friends and gamers talk about media, role-playing, hobbying,
and sometimes even Kings of War.
We could keep talking over this intro song,
but John spent 30 whole minutes composing and recording it, so
instead, kick back and enjoy some sweet, sweet metal.
Hello, and welcome to a really long overdue and highly anticipated, at least in my mind, episode of Unplugged Radio. I'm one of your hosts, Greg.
I'm your host, John.
I'm the other host, Mike. What's up?
We're up here again.
Things are happening.
John, are you eating right now?
I have a paintbrush in my mouth.
Okay.
Eating paint. You can
picture. Yeah, eating paint. Okay. That's a great segue because we're going to start off, you know, what have we been up to in the hobby? It's been several months since we've actually sat down and recorded an episode. If you listened to our most recent episode with Jeremy Duvall from Countercharge, shout out to Jeremy. That was recorded a long time ago at this point. It took us a while to get it published because we were going through some changes with one podcast feed to a new podcast feed, which we'll touch more on in a moment. But that got up. So hopefully you listened to that and enjoyed it. But here we are with some brand new content. So the field is open. It's been several months. What have we been up to in the hobby? John, you're actively painting right now. So why don't you start us off and tell us what you got going on?
Yeah. Well, kind of a variety of things, actually. I picked up the final set for the Into the Dark Kill Team box. There was one that I had missed because I was traveling when the pre-order came out for it, so I missed it, and then it totally sold out. And it's funny because while I was in Europe, I actually saw an English version of it in a store, and I thought, oh, I should pick that up because I missed it on the pre-order. And but I said, how the hell am I going to fit that in my luggage? So I didn't buy it, and this is a huge box, and then I was never able to find it again, and it, you know, it had completely sold out in the U.S. So I was at, I was down in Connecticut. I was playing a game with Jim or Chris, maybe. I think it was Jim, maybe both of them. It's possible. And the store there had a copy of not the whole box, but just the parts I wanted from it in the commission case.
Wow.
And I said, oh, what are the chances of that? So I went and picked that up for kind of a song. It wasn't super expensive because it was just the terrain part.
It was only part.
Yeah. Right. So I painted that up, and I now have a like full 6x4 tables worth of this interior spaceship corridor terrain all painted up. And I set it up the other day, and Jeff came over, and me and my son Tony and Jeff and I, we played like a playtest kind of. Let's see how it goes, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so my intent, and I need to send the invite out this afternoon, is to invite a bunch of Kill Team players over and do a like 6 to 8 player narrative spaceship game that I will GM. And so that was kind of a big accomplishment just to complete that. It was a lot of terrain. It's like, I don't know, 100 linear feet of spaceship walls or something. Like
yeah,
that.
You sent out the pictures a couple times. It is quite the undertaking. And I will add, we talked about this in text, but I've never played Kill Team. I'm not going to paint a Kill Team, but if someone hands me a Kill Team, which I think you have about 48 of them by now, I would show up and roll dice and play that because that sounds awesome.
Perfect. Yeah. So that's the plan with it, right? It's going to be just a narrative game just for mm-hmm. fun. I've got all these environmental like effects and scatter terrain to go in it and stuff. And so I've been eyeing this for a long time now, ever since it came out. It just took a really long time to get it all together, but it's finally here. So I'm prepared for that. I'm very much looking forward to it. I painted a high elf the other day, finished her off. I sent some pictures. I posted it on the Facebook group, actually. I've got a number of elf models sitting around that I don't really use for, I don't like need necessarily for Kings of War. Mm-hmm. But I also don't like, I'd like to paint them. So this was a handmaiden of the Everqueen. I also have the Everqueen. Some other, you know, I've got some, what are they called? Sisters of Avalorn. So I've got more of them that could very well be like Gladestalkers or something. So I'm going to like slowly work through some of these older High Elf models and just like sprinkle them into the army here or there. So I've been doing
Those are some really nice models. And I thought the one you just painted up came out well. It was meant to be just a wizard, or what character was that? Nimue Waydancer? Is that
what I was going to use it as Nimue Waydancer. Like it's not like a perfect representation, but I figured just like as an excuse to throw it on the table and something to use it as, it would fit for that.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was going to be the model to finish off your elf list for Crossroads.
Right. But
unfortunately, work had other plans for you and you will no longer be attending Crossroads. Sad face. Yeah. But you did get the model painted, which is a nice accomplishment.
Exactly. At least I made some progress, even if I don't get to go use it quite yet. And maybe by the time I get to play in another tournament, I'll have something else, because I have another little of the old High Elf units on my painting bench. And if I can fit that in, I'll have a new unit to play with as well.
Yeah, maybe we'll see some new elves at Dead of Winter.
Yeah, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Speaking of... Do you remember the GW Wood Elf Glade Riders?
Yeah.
Do you have any of those?
I do not.
Not painted? Oh.
No.
The plastic ones are like the old metal plastic.
No, not the old metal ones. Those suck.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are good models. Yeah.
I know. They also are $115 for a box.
Ouch.
Because I went searching for them. So I don't know. I was hoping that some of my friends have a giant basement full of crap like I do. So, I need another six.
I'm sure they exist out there amongst our gaming circle.
That's right. Somebody's got to have them.
Yeah, but I'm not your guy there, unfortunately.
Totally understood.
Jim would have wood elves if you... a person.
Yep.
Let's see what Mr. Ellsworth is up to.
Yeah, so I've been playing some games, too. Kind of a variety of different stuff. The one that's been exciting for me, though, just this weekend, was the new version of D&D came out. And I grabbed the rule book. We played on Friday night. Great, that was fun. It was fun to try out some of the new rules. But the really fun part was I've been playing a kid centric RPG with my kids. It's called Hero Kids. It's very lightweight rules, lightweight adventures. But with the new rules out, I said, I think they're very much into the role-playing aspects of this. I think we can step up to a slightly more complicated rule set. I don't know if I'll use all the D&D rules, but I think it'd be fun to go through character creation. Because in Hero Kids, you just get a character.
You're from a list.
Yeah, you're a warlock, and you shoot fire or you attack with your hands. Like, you just have two abilities. It's pretty straightforward. But I think I could take a D&D character, go through the character creation process, and then apply that to these kind of really streamlined kid-centric adventures. And that'll be fun, but still a little bit more involved. I thought the new rules were a great opportunity to give that a try. So I ran my son through last night. He wanted to be a barbarian, of course. So we created our first new barbarian.
I love it.
A lot of fun, you know, choosing the options. And it was a great exercise for somebody who's learning how to do handwriting in, you know, practicing penmanship.
Right.
Always try to work in some of those educational opportunities.
No, and it's motivating too, right? Because he gets to use it to play this game that he loves to play. So.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. So that's me. Been just kind of here and there doing stuff. How about you, Mike? What are you up to?
The thing I'm actually starting to work on now is a wood elf project.
Glade Riders.
Yeah, so I listened to the wood elf review, or the Sylvankin review on Countercharge, and I have been playing dwarves now for years, and no matter how much I fiddle with it, and yes, Ordered March is good and gives me some level of mobility, the threat projection isn't really there, right? And at Masters, I played a lot of lists that were, after the first day, there was one that was six regiments of pack hunters, three giants, all with breath weapons and two Kimura. Right. And so the whole thing just flew around and shot and stuff. And I was like, well, this is a negative play experience. And then I ended up playing against a lot of Twi'lekin that are also be weakened, be shot from far away. Right. And everything projects a huge threat. And then an all flying army. So it was a lot of like me playing against armies that were not exactly hard counters, but really I didn't feel as if I was in the game. Right. Right. Yep. Because, you know, if your fastest thing moves 7, what can you do? I know defense 6 is good. And all those games I was close to, I made it competitive, right? It wasn't like I was just, it was over before it began. But they were, I was like, all right, so I gotta rethink my how I approach the game, because I've been doing Dwarves for so long that I understand it only from that one context. And so yeah. In my mind, I was like, I can either do like a hyper fluid, mobile, lots of nimble, elf list where I'm everywhere, and then be patient and then decide when to attack. Or I could do, cause I have a lot of the minis for that. And then, or I could do something with like undead with a lot of surge, and I'm opting for the wood elf one. Just cause I was pretty inspired. Right. And I have enough minis for an existing regiment of Stormwind, a regiment of the Glade Riders, or the, you know, the equivalent, right? The Windborne.
Silver Breeze,
right? Mm-hmm. I have enough minis where I can put about 1,500 points down on the table right now. And nice. So I started dry brushing some Treekin models that are that were 3D printed, and getting to work on those, and really taking a look at like getting a thing on the table, with the idea being that I know, because I finished really good at Orktown, and I did, yep, and I did really good at another tournament, that essentially I'm going to make the Masters team this year, but I don't want to bring Dwarves to Masters.
Yeah. Right.
Well, because between those two and the fact that I run Dead of Winter, then it'll even out to be a pretty decent score, right?
Oh, so, yeah. Right. So you've got to figure out something you feel comfortable playing with then.
Right. And so if I'm going to do this, I have to start right now, which means I'm going to start gaming probably with like proxy bases and just fill them in, you know, fill them up. But yeah, so I mean, the one thing that I've been working on is, like I said, is dry brushing some minis, trying to get my stuff together. I have Harry building up a couple STLs for me. And then the last thing would be the basing. Right. And so the idea in the very beginning, I've been talking about this for years, is this idea of a giant tree. Well, I have, because of 3D printing technology now, I can do that. Right. Right. And so working through that, which will then turn into the basing for any of the stuff that isn't on a horse. Right. Because they'll be up in the branches. Right.
Yeah.
Should work pretty well. And then I'm going to take a horde of infantry. I'm not exactly sure if they're going to be, you know, what they'll probably be the forest hunters, right? And that's where the base of the tree will live, right? So that horde becomes
the center
of the army, right? And then the branches over the top with the archers in it and stuff. But now, like, it can be done, you know? Years ago when I was trying to make it out of, like, wire mesh and paper mache, I'm like, this totally sucks, right? This is going nowhere. But in a world where hollow resin and a 3D printer is totally accessible, right, this should
that's
be
very different, very, very doable, different,
you know? Yeah.
So I have this strong image in my mind, and I realize these references I'm pulling at something only people of a certain age will remember, but I grew up reading the Berenstain Bears books.
Yeah.
And there was one particular book where, I don't know, the son and his friends make a treehouse, and there's a sign outside the treehouse that says no girls allowed. And that, you know, that sparks like the whole conversation. Yeah. But I'm picturing your tree design with a hand painted sign that says no stunties allowed.
That's it. That's exactly it. Right.
Yeah.
That's totally right. Uh-huh. Right. Just a little sign that says Golic sucks. Right.
Yeah.
Please leave now. Right.
Your 18 inch range can't hit us up here.
That's right. Snack it. Right, sharpshooters or get out. So that's the plan. Like I said, I started working on dry brushing, just keeping it simple, right? No delusions of grandeur. Let's just get a unit of forest shamblers done.
Get something done.
And then we'll do another one, and then we'll go from there, right? And then if I want to go back and add additional detail to the leaves and stuff, and I'm actually thinking about dry brushing it so I could do contrast paints if I want to, and then leaving the leaf colors alone until I've decided whether I want to do fall or if I want to do a green. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because yeah. I mean, because that's going to totally change, you know.
Yeah. Oh. I have a question for you, Mike. You yeah. are anticipating being able to get this whole army done this year?
So the only reason why I think I could do it is because based on what I wrote down and the minis that I have, and the minis
you already have some what else.
Well, that's it, right? Like I've already got I've already got like 36 archers painted. I've got three regiments of cavalry painted. You know what I mean? If I incorporate those into the army, and the downside is they're all, because they're all Warhammer minis, they're all individually based, so I have to figure that out. Right. And if I have new minis that I get that I get printed up, do I opt to say this is the old, this is the old, this is the new? I mean, they're close, right? And say this unit that looks like it's old has this magic item, and this unit over here has this magic item. Or do you combine the minis, right? Yeah. Mix them and then have it look a little. I don't know how jarring it's going to be until I see the printed STLs in my hands.
Right.
Yeah. But in terms of the actual number of minis I need to paint, it's like 40.
Okay.
That's totally doable, right? It's totally doable. Yeah. The thing that's actually going to take more time out of all of it is the basing, right? The basing. I still cannot get the basing to look like yours, Greg, and I just have base envy, right? So I gotta figure it out.
Not at Crossroads because you're not going, but we have to sit down and have a little tutorial session.
Something. Even if it's just like, I watch you as you do it over video. Right, would be totally fine, you know. But so I am
interested at some point to get into it with you about like your list design and your thoughts behind it. Because although I've never played Sylvankin, I've written many Sylvankin lists because this is what I do, right? Like I fantasize about what army am I going to make next, and because I have a pretty decent number of points from Forces of Nature, that like. You know, lends itself into other army lists. Sylvankin, perhaps being chief among them.
Yep.
Because I have all the Forest Shamblers and the Tree Herder and the Hunters of the Wild and the Force Warden, etc. Just gives you a great
starting point.
And I've always thought, like, because I use a couple regiments of Forest Shamblers with my Forest of Nature army, and I like how they perform in that list, but I look at the units available in Sylvankin and think the Forest Shambler regiments, you would get so much more out of them when you have these other fast, hard-hitting elements that can play off of them scouting up with their fearless nerve and getting in obnoxious positions.
Right. And then having a line of heavy cavalry behind them.
Mm-hmm.
Right, to say if you want to attack that, that's totally cool, but I'm going to come get you. Downside is,
and here's what comes to get you,
right? Yeah. Well, the downside is the Forest Shamblers are height 3, and so is the cavalry. So depending on what, you know, you have to be able to get your line of sight so you can see the target to do the double charge on the counter. But I'm really thinking that's probably how it's going to end up working. I'm really debating not taking a Tree Herder, right?
Yeah,
I don't. I think they're great. I think they're the obvious choice. I will probably default eventually to
take so a Tree Herder,
but I want to play around with not having one.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and go from there. But yeah, I agree. I think it's going to be a lot of nimble and a lot of movement, right?
Nice.
So long range threat projection and setting traps, and so we'll see. It's going to be totally different than the dwarf list, which is kind of what I'm shooting for. I'm going to be okay if I take a pounding this year and not really do well, because I'm learning something new. But I'm just bored of doing the same thing over and over again. You know,
I think learning a new army is not that hard, though. Like, it's, you know, it does take a little bit of time to get up and going, but you've got a runway with it, and it's not like you've never played the game before. So
that's true, right?
I'd say you'll probably be all right.
Yeah, I would imagine so. I'm not worried about it. So cool.
How about you, Greg?
So I went through a long, long drought of not engaging in any hobby. And that culminated with like a month left before Masters. And, you know, obviously I already had my army painted. It's been painted for a while, but I had this vision of making a special display board. Masters this year. Oh, hold on. Give me one moment.
Sure.
For what it's worth, while Greg has a step away, Mike, I am in the process of painting lightning bolts on a Space Marine's armor, and I hate this. I'm not good at it.
Really? Is it just you know, you go to do a lightning bolt and you're like, this just looks like a jagged, stupid, like the line work doesn't look, or is it the effect of having the white with the blue and the?
I'm struggling to get them consistently looking like lightning and not like weird jagged lines.
Yeah, totally. So I find the exact same problem.
I'm looking at a bunch of pictures online as like reference here, and I see, oh, like, oh yeah, theirs looks like lightning. Why doesn't mine look like lightning? It's right.
It's boring.
All right, I'm back.
Hey-o.
Sorry about that.
No problem.
Let me just restart my train of thought. Yeah. Okay. All right. So I went through a long drought where I was not engaging in any hobby, which stretched on for maybe 7 or 8 months, definitely longer than I wanted it to, and I had got into a rut where it was like, haven't done this in so long, to start it back up seems like a big investment, and I don't know if I can bring myself to do it, yada, yada, yada.
Right.
Well, Masters is what broke that for me. You know, Masters was last weekend in August, start of September. And although my dwarf army that I was taking to it had been finished painted for, you know, I'd finished painting it for a while, I had a vision in my head of doing a special display board. Masters was in D.C., which is driving distance for me in Connecticut. And so the display board that I've been using for several years now, I built it to be generic looking enough to fit with either my Forces of Nature or my Ogres or my Dwarf Army. And it's small enough that I can put it into a suitcase that I, you know, check on a flight. And it just isn't, it looks fine, but it's not the way in my mind I wanted to visually present my army. So I pulled the trigger with maybe a month before the event, and I got the things that I needed, and I started working on it very slowly, half-heartedly. And then there were like 3 weeks to go, and I was like, oh man, I'm never going to finish this unless I really ramp up my work. So that turned into basically every night working, painting, building, doing basing. From somewhere around like 9 to 10 p.m. until like 1 to 2 in the morning. And for the first week of that, that was okay because I was still on summer break. I am a teacher. But then the last 2 weeks of it, we were back and I was working full time. And that was insanity. But I was so committed, like I was already like, you know, half in, like I couldn't just,
yeah, what are you gonna do at that point?
Yeah, I had to finish the job, so I really was starting to question my sanity at the end, but I got it all done and then some, and I was really pleased with the result. So basically, you know, and I'm gonna post pictures. I've been waiting to post pictures from Masters onto the Unplugged Radio Instagram account because I wanted to kind of do it side by side with us releasing this episode. So those pictures will be there. I'll put them on our Discord and you know, places like that. But essentially it's just a flat board, but it's much larger than the one I'd been using. And so the army takes up probably like the first 2/3 of the physical space. And then in the back, on when you're looking at it from the front, on the left-hand side, I have this very large terrain piece, which is called the Citadel Scenery Dwarf Mountain Stronghold.
It's awesome.
If you're a longtime Warhammer player like I am, and you're familiar with 6th edition era, this terrain piece was released around then. It's made from foam, and it's like the back is like these big, like boulder, rocky areas, and built into that is a little entryway, like into a dwarf mountain stronghold, and then built off of that is like a stone platform. It's kind of like a front porch. I don't know how else to describe it. And it has like these ornate stone walls around it. And then towards the top, there's a little platform and there's like a space for a lookout. So that terrain piece, if you remember seeing pictures of it or you look it up, it doesn't, like the design of it is cool, but the way it's painted just out of the bag, because it comes in a bag, is very bland. It's like a muted gray. And then there's like bright green static grass like around it. And so I did like a complete overhaul of this model. I covered all of the static grass and some other parts of it with the Vallejo texture paint. And then I sprayed it all black and I painted it up like from the ground up. And then I used my own static grass mixture and the flowers and the other basing elements that I have to like make it look nice and match with the board and match with the bases. And then I painted a whole bunch of things to go on it. So I have a lookout who's like a dwarf who's waving a flag. He was part of the flame cannon crew, the metal flame cannon from, again, from the 6th edition era. And then I have, on one side of it, I have this rack of axes that comes from Malachi McKeyson's Goblin Hewer. And I have one of the Slayer crew members, the one who's like just taken an axe off the rack, and he's kind of like rubbing his thumb along the blade to test its sharpness, which I love that model. And I was looking for a place to use it. And then I have a dwarven brewery that's on it. Which ended up being larger than I thought it was. So that miniature comes from this great website. It's called minimonsters.eu. I got other terrain features from there. If you've seen my sharpshooters, they're standing behind a stone wall with like runes and dwarven faces carved into it. I got those from this website, and they have other, I mean, they have lots of stuff, not just dwarf themed terrain, but that's the only part I've really looked at. And they have this brewery, and it's freaking awesome. It's got like this giant, like metal, I don't know what you would call it, kettle, this metal, like, globe that the beer is in, and then it funnels through these different pipes, and it has like barrels, and there's like controls on it, and then it pours all out into two kegs, and then the kegs have taps, and then there's like this massive chimney coming off of it to like release the steam or whatever. And so I painted that up again using like the color scheme of the army to try and match, and that sits on one side of it. And then in front of it I have two of the old, these were like 5th edition era, I think, drunk dwarfs. And so there's one who's like kind of leaned back and raising his tankard in celebration. And then there's the other one who's like slumped over his weapon, like passed out, and his tankard is limp in his hand. So I've got those two guys in front of it. And then I also have the 6th edition era white dwarf who's lifting up his helm, and he's holding it upside down, and it's got ale inside of it kind of spilling out. So it's like he just filled it up there, and he's surveying the battlefield. So it was a massive amount of work. It was basically doing that and then doing the board itself. And on the board, so that's in the back on the left side. The other side, I put a bunch of trees, which I just bought Woodland Scenics, like the pre... I know John and I built a lot of the armatures ourselves and painted them and used hot glue to add
many,
the foliage.
Many trees. Oh my gosh.
We singed many fingertips doing this, setting up for Unplugged GT. And I knew I didn't have time to do all that myself, so I bought the ones that are decidedly
much more expensive. It's super cost effective to do yourself. It's like $16 for four large trees when they're pre-finished. But I did those, and I added like some washes onto the bark and branches to make it look a little more visually interesting.
Yeah.
But I put those all along the back. So it was like, you know, the mountain hold is like kind of in the beginnings of the forest, and then the army's in front of it. And then there was a little blank space amongst the trees, and I had a little more time. So I got the miniature that I would use if I ever take a Greater Earth Elemental as the Greater Earth Elemental. It's like the Mom Miniatures Runic Guardian, but the large monster size one.
I love that mini.
Yeah. So I use the smaller ones for my Earth Elementals, and then I've had the larger one for a while. I was going to bring him to Orktown, but then I didn't end up being able to go to Orktown. So I was like, screw it. I'm going to paint him. He's going to look really cool standing in the back of the army, like emerging from the woods. And I did that. And so I got it all done. And it's also, the display board is on, the base of it is a dry erase board that's magnetized. So I put the texture paint, well, I did it like this. I arranged the army on it, including the terrain piece, exactly where I wanted it. And I outlined all of that with a like a paint pen, so I would know exactly where all the units would sit. And then I covered the rest of it with the texture paint. So the display board is actually meant to hold this army list, and really only this army list, because, you know, the units sit flat and they have magnets on them, so they hold. Not super strong, because the dry erase board, like, magnetic field isn't very strong, but enough that when you're transporting it from point A to point B at a tournament, nothing's going to slide, or if somebody bumps into you, it shouldn't fall over, kind of thing. So, Yep, that's what I did. It was a lot of work. I felt like I was going crazy, but I was really proud that I got it finished. I drove to DC on a Friday. So I went to work. I was able to leave a little bit early because I didn't happen to teach the last period of the day, and I just got permission to bounce around like 1 o'clock. And I drove for like 7.5 hours, and I set everything up in the hall. I said hi to a few people, and I was like, I'm on like 4 hours of sleep a night for like 2 weeks. I'm going to bed.
Right.
And I got a good night's sleep before Masters. And that was that.
That's legit.
Yep. And then since Masters, I have not touched a paintbrush. But
yeah, that's to be expected though, right? I mean,
I'm hoping to find some balance moving forward where it's not all or nothing like that.
Yeah, sure. Right. The grind is good when you got to get it done, but it's not very sustainable.
Yeah, totally true. Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Awesome. We've been busy.
I do have to say, Greg, that Greg was very busy, like sending us pictures as he was doing, you know, that frantic last push, right? So, hey, I got this done. Here's a picture. Check this out. It's coming along. And how prolific, dude. That is the result of years of painting that allows you to paint to that high level and hobby to that high level consistently and quickly. Right. Like if I sat down to do that, I mean, we just talked about it. Mike, how many models do you actually have to paint in a year? I'm like, I don't know. It's not going to be bad, like 40 something. And in the back of my mind, I'm like, right now, dude, you're on 3 per year. Yeah. Like, so at my current rate, that would take 11 years to get done. Greg did all of that in a matter of a couple of weeks. And then what happened at Masters? What did you win?
I won the best painted.
Oh, yeah. Best painted.
This, you know, but, no big deal.
But I do want to make it clear. And this was, you know, I did all of this work and I wanted to have this awesome display board. It was very explicitly laid out in the pack that display boards do not count towards your painting, like your appearance score at Masters, because, you know, which I agree with, because we got people traveling from all over. They might not be able to bring, you know, that type of thing. But obviously they would factor in for like player's choice vote. And also I really just wanted, like, I've loved that terrain piece since I started playing this game at 13 years old, and I would look at the pictures in the Dwarf Army book, and I've always wanted to do it justice. And so I did all that. It was just
an opportunity as much as
it was an opportunity. It didn't really count towards anything. But now I have it, and it's awesome.
Yeah.
And if you didn't see it at Masters, you will see it at Crossroads. There you go.
Right? Yeah, it's super awesome. And just, I don't know, look at any of the faces on the dwarves, right, in real time, and just take a look at it and just be be amazed is a strong word. But, man, it is so tight. Your painting is so tight, you know?
Thank you.
Yep. Cool.
So it's obviously been a while, and we like to talk on this show about not only what we've been doing in the hobby, but what we've been reading. But there is one book in particular that is on our minds, and it's a book that if all of you out there have not been reading yet, what are you doing? Get with the times, because after years of hard work, of love, blood, sweat, and tears, all of it being poured into this, Mike Rossi's first novel, Honor's Price, has officially hit the shelves. You can pick it up, physical copy, digital copy, and you can sink your teeth into what I have every confidence saying is the best novel set in Panathor that we have seen to date. Mike, where can they get this if they want to read along with us?
So that's a great question, Greg. Well, thanks. So as Greg mentioned, it's nicely done. As Greg mentioned, like, the book is actually out now. It was out for pre-order a while ago, and now it's out in the general population. You can order it on Amazon, though last time I looked, I think it was on back order because it's sold out on Amazon. Thank you, everybody.
Oh, yeah.
Bank now. As I keep telling people, I have no idea if Amazon only had a box of 50. And then they're like, "Ah, oh, sorry, we sold out of all 50. I don't know what the actual starting is, but so now, like, I think when you go to order it, even if you have Amazon Prime or anything, it'll say, you know, sometime we'll get it to you sometime in October. You can also order directly from Wing to Star Publishing. Go to whpsupplyroom.com and you can get a copy there. They'll send it to you. You can also, if you have an e-reader, you can get it on Kindle and Nook. I know a couple people that I know around here have purchased it on e-reader, and it's pretty awesome. It's out. People seem to, a lot of people apparently have purchased it, and the people who read it seem to like it. So that's kind of good, right? Because, I mean, in the big scheme of things, I've always told people, like, listen, I want to write something, and when you read it, not be like, oh my God, I wasted my life reading this. Like, it's, you know, I want people to be mildly okay with the fact that they gave me a couple hours of their time. And that, you know, they feel that the story was fun, right? So I'm just super heartened to have a copy in my hand finally of the hard copy of the book. Because I was supposed to get copies, and there was a mix up. I ended up going to Masters, and while I was there, Ray Shields was like, "Here's a copy of the book. Can you sign it for me?" And I'm like, "How surreal is this?"
Like, so, I haven't even seen this yet.
Seriously, right? So I had it in my hand. I took a picture and I was flipping through it. I'm like, oh my God, these are my words, right? So super cool. Turns out that the company, this is how long ago, when I signed the contract with Wing to Sar, I lived at a different address, right?
Yeah.
This is before I moved in with, you know, my wife and everything else. And so they were like, yeah, we sent you the copies. And according to this, they were delivered. I'm like, send me a picture. So there's, honest to God, it's the picture of my old front porch. I'm like, son of a... So I had to drive over there. Ding dong, right? Hi, I used to own this house, and I wrote a book. And I think they were delivered to the house. And this, I think the lady who bought the house, I think this was her son. He was like, oh yeah, no, we got a box like 2 weeks ago. I mean, we tried to return it, and the post wouldn't take it. So there's a weird pause, and I go, so what? Where are they?
Oh, you threw it out.
They're in the garage. I'll go get them. I mean, it's like 3 p.m. The kid had just woken up from something, right? And while he's walking away, he's like, "Yeah, you wrote a book. That's really cool." And then the door closes and shuts. Goes, "Yeah, I got the box right here." So he hands me the box, and I run home. I open it up, and there are the copies. But very, anyway, it was it, the entire thing has been very surreal. I have I'm just so happy that it's done. Yep. And it, like I said, people seem to be liking it. So if you want, please go order it. Put it in your ears. If you got an ear reader, if you have an e-reader, I think it's like $11. It's $10. Like it's, you know, it's nothing money, right?
Yeah. So I do have a question for you, Mike, because you said, like, you know, sometimes when folks get a book published, especially if it's their first book, they like write a draft of the book and then they try and like, you know, find a publisher who's going to pick it up.
Right.
And so there can be, for a first novel, there can be like a long time lapse between when it's written, at least the first draft, and when it's published. But in your case, as you said, you signed a contract. Wingtisar agreed to publish your book. You know, you talked about, here's what it's going to be about. Here's like, you know, some of the stuff. Now go and do it. And you did it.
Right.
And then you went back and forth with some edits or whatever. And then you had a finished copy. But then there was still a long delay.
Yeah.
Like, how long was there between you were like, you know,
this is done,
put the proverbial pen down and we're done touching it, and when it actually published?
So there's two phases of that, right? So
I
wrote the book. I wrote the first draft with Mindy, Corey, a couple others looking over my shoulder, being like, all right, this works. Nah, it doesn't work. And so, but that took about 15 months. So I had the book done in 2022.
Wow.
Okay.
The very beginning of 2022. And then I said, okay, I submitted it to Mantic. Hey, just, you know, Matt Gilbert, if you feel like looking at it, go ahead. Sent it to Wingtisar. Brandon Rossbond, here it is. And he's like, okay, cool. When I got it done, they were just coming out of COVID. And he's like, because of COVID, the publishing, like, our schedule is messed up. I need to fit you in. In the meantime, Mantic had come out and said, hey, we're going to be doing Ben Stoddard's trilogy of dwarf books. And because those had to be, all three of them had to be done by a certain date, they had to push mine back and him forward. Okay, fine. And then there was another one that had to be released beforehand. I said, okay, fine. But Brandon didn't actually look at it to start editing it until about 19, 20 months had gone by. Wow. Because he was still catching, right? So it wasn't just with like he looked at it and said, go, right. So when he was ready, we sat down. He gave me his edits. I sulked because I expected him to say that my writing was perfect, which it wasn't.
Right.
Right. Because what do I know? and so, you know, that back and forth took another 6 months of, I made the initial edits. We talked a bunch of stuff out. I sent him. He sent another revised copy back. I made more edits. So that back and forth, there were three rounds of edits. Because that's usually what he does with every novel. I had to take some stuff out and move some stuff around. And then it got into the publisher. And then from there, I think it was sent to the publisher in December and didn't come out. No, it was like February. And it didn't come out until September. It got pushed back a couple times once again. I mean, apparently printing things is hard. So, but the entire thing, front to back, took around five, coming up on 5 years now, right?
Yeah.
Part of that was it takes time to write, and part of it was the almost 2 year gap in between when my first round was done and when he could start editing, right? But I'm just super, I don't know, like I'm super thankful.
Yeah.
You know.
So I guess like now that we've like established that timeline, my question is this, like, you know, when I do a creative thing, paint a model, I write something, you know, I build something, people see it and you get feedback in that moment and like a sense of validation. I'm like, you did this project that was more involved probably than any creative project you've ever done.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you don't really like, you have like a handful of people around you who are looking at it and giving you some feedback, but not like a wide audience. Like there's like this long gap of like, I wrote this thing, I really want everyone to read it and tell me what they think, but years go by before you can have that. So how does it feel to start to get some of that?
It's super cool. And it's actually funny. So when I submitted the first draft, you know, the first final draft to Brandon, he said, I can't get to this. So he suggested that I send it to some people that I respected in the community. So I sent copies out to, I mean, you guys had already seen it, right? So I sent a copy out, made sure a revised copy went out to Jake. I sent it out to Keith Randall, who I've gotten some really good book recommendations from. Sent it to Steve Hildrew. And I got feedback from them, right? And Steve actually had some very, very, very amazingly good things to say and some very good comments about the overall flow of the book. Keith's feedback was actually, he gave me some suggestions that I put in word for word, right? He's like, this phrasing is Unky, do this. And I was like, that's infinitely better. And so there's a couple phrases in there where when he reads it, he's going to go, oh yeah, that's mine, right? But at that point though, I was still getting like, this is really great. This is great. Cause I mean, when Steve called me, Steve Hildrew, he was like, it's good. And I go, is it good for like a game novel? He's like, nah, bro, it's a good novel, period. And I was like, whoa, all right, well, that's amazing. Tell me more. Right. Yeah. So, but that's all that I got.
There is a difference between those
totally
statements.
Is. So when I got those, when I got that editorial feedback from Brandon Rossbaum, he's like, yeah, this part doesn't work. You do this. You have this weird thing that you do that you got to stop doing. I was like, oh my God, too much use of the old inner voice. No problem. I'll get that figured out, though. My inner voice never shuts up. So I did a lot of that revision. And now that it's out, I don't want to be like, I mean, to your point, I do want feedback. I want to know how I did, both good and bad. But there's a part of me, it's like everybody who's like, I got the book. I'm like, start reading it yet? Start reading it now? How about now? Did you read it now? Did you get to this part? What part
did
you get to?
Yeah, you don't want to be annoying.
I know, but I totally need some sort of like, need some sort of, not validation, but what I do need is some sort of feedback that says, yes, this was good, or because I'm thinking about doing another. And so when I do another, the way that I'm wired is I want to make sure that the next time I keep the stuff that people liked and I make changes to, you know, the stuff that maybe didn't land or didn't work.
Right.
You know,
that makes sense.
Yeah, you know, so that's kind of where I'm at right now. But yeah, I'm super jazzed. Yeah, dude. Super
awesome. That's awesome, dude. Congratulations. Yeah. It's really,
well, thank you.
It's quite the accomplishment. I mean, my copy is sitting on my desk and I'm traveling next week, which is why I can't go to Crossroads for work. And I'm going to bring it with me. And that's my reading for the
trip. Right. And it is funny. I was talking to Mindy, my wife, last week before I went away for that conference. I was just at. And I said, you know, I think this year I'm going to have enough free time where I can sit down and I can either begin really working on my next novel or I can sit down and paint an army. And I think I'm leading toward actually painting an army because it's going to be better for my, I mean, that's this Wood Elf project, right? Right. It's going to be better for my health with the relationship to the game. Right. But, you know, which means I'll sketch out the book because I have the first three chapters in draft form written. And I'm finding my voice with the characters, but I'm at a spot now where I'm like, all right, so
you're a little further along in this process than.
Yeah. Right. But it's not the best writing, but it is something on paper because I'm trying stuff. Right. And then, and then I know where the end is. I know the last scene and I know the things that are revealed as part of the book, but I don't know any of the intermediate steps to get there. And when I wrote Honor's Price, I took 4 months just to write out character sketches and chapter setups.
Mm-hmm.
This happens, which causes this to happen, which causes this to happen, but this happens, which makes this happen. Right. I had to do that. So that there was a beginning, a middle and an end and the story went somewhere.
Right. Right.
Right. So, I didn't want to write myself into a corner. Right. So I was very structured about it, you know,
for your first time too. Now you got a little bit of your feet under you there.
Yeah. And so that I think that if I took some time this year while I'm painting to just really think through in the, you know, subroutine in the back of my head about the steps that are going to happen in this new novel with new characters, right? Like I think that it'll be a better product at the end, you know?
That makes sense.
Yeah, buddy.
But, beautiful. Yeah. So I want to tie in another element to our discussion about your book, which is that we did relaunch our podcast onto a new feed. We talked a little bit about that in a recording that went out a month or two ago, so we don't need to rehash that. But what it does mean is that when you search up Unplugged Radio on iTunes, we are no longer the same feed we were before. So if you were subscribed to us, this episode didn't pop up for you. You have to search again and find us. And I think it even says like Unplugged Radio 2. Is like the title that comes up. And so you can find us on iTunes. You can find us on the Countercharge website, which is where we're hosting our stuff now, and we're very thankful to Rob and Co. for that. You can find us where else on what other streaming platforms can people get this on? Spotify?
Yep, we're on Spotify. I got to figure it out for iTunes. You can just go to our new website, which once again, thank you very much, Rob Fanuff, for providing us some server space over at Countercharge Inc. So yeah, those are the two that you could look for. But you have to look, and it's funny, there's a meta thing here. You have to look for Unplugged Radio 2. But you wouldn't know that. Well, you would know that because you're listening to this right now.
So somehow you found us here.
Right. So we have to go.
Somehow you found us.
Right. So, yeah. So we have to do a social media blitz to get it out there. Hey guys, yes. we exist. And anyway.
So the website, just to be clear, the website with the home to us is countercharge.net/unpluggedradio2.
Right.
Okay. So I say all this because when you follow Unplugged Radio 2 on iTunes, which I hope you do, at least as of the other day when I looked it up, we don't have any reviews, no ratings or reviews yet. So we would like to encourage listeners to leave us a review on iTunes. And what I am going to tell you right now to incentivize you beyond just like that great feeling of self-satisfaction and pride you will get from knowing you've left us a review on iTunes.
Yeah.
Is that every time we record an episode, starting the next episode we put out and stretching on, who knows, perhaps into eternity until we feel like it, we are going to draw and announce one lucky winner. We'll just look at who's left an iTunes review, whether that's one person or it's 50 people. We'll pull one of those names at random, and we are going to send you a copy of Honor's Price by Mike Rossi.
Yeah, buddy. Hopefully you like it.
Hopefully you like it. And if you already own a copy, we've just given you something that you have full permission to gift to a friend.
Perfect.
And we will not be offended. Right?
Yeah.
So that's what we're saying. Whether you use iTunes as your primary source for podcasts or not, please go on there. If you would like to be entered into this contest, leave us a review. And like I said, if your name is attached to it, we'll just pull one each time we record. And, you know, if you don't get pulled the first time, you could 4, 5, 6 times down the line still get your name called. But we would like to encourage people to leave those reviews, and we'd like to reward you for it and send more copies of Mike's novel around the community.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you. And everybody out there for just, I don't know, giving me a chance. And also, thank you for following us into this new podcast feed in this new realm here. I mean, this is super cool, right? I mean, we rising from the ashes, baby. Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we need to make a change, but we're here.
Yeah. All right.
So final note on Honor's Price. Is there a section of the novel that you would like to read aloud for us to give our listeners a little taste of what is in store for them if they have yet to open up their copy?
Sure. I can actually read the first couple paragraphs. So this is a good place to start. Actually, I'll just read this one section here. This is just straight off the prologue. Rhys's footsteps echoed on the weathered stone tiles as he walked through the halls of Lingir Cadu, the seat of Clan Damuz. He ruefully reflected that all he did these days was bring Lord Drozun bad news. Today was no different. His rangers had spotted the enemy's advanced scouts only a day's march away. The Abyssal Dwarf army would arrive in 2-3 days at most. This is where the real smelting starts, he thought. We're out of time. Clan Damuz had known the fiends were coming for days, and they prepared as best they could. They spent days harvesting the last of the crops, fortifying the walls, and training every dwarf who could hold a spear, but they were still far from ready. Rhys was bewildered at the rangers' accounts of the sheer size of the enemy army. Reports of thousands of abyssal dwarves leading hordes of orcs and Rakan slaves had been filtering back for days now. It made no sense. How had the enemy become so powerful and so quickly? He turned a corner and ran into a regiment of dwarves marching the other way toward the main gate of the keep. Normally, they would have stepped aside for the leader of the clan's rangers, but the warriors were too focused on the task at hand to notice Rhys at all. And Rhys was easy to notice, taller and broader than most dwarves by a few inches, with a shock of unkempt auburn hair that made him seem even taller, and ice-blue eyes that pinned people in place when he spoke to them. Rhys now found himself swimming against the tide of armored dwarves, and he was forced to slide his way to the side of the hallway to allow the regiment of warriors to pass. Rhys took the mild disrespect stoically, realizing that the warriors were justifyingly edgy, with little room for niceties. So, that's the first couple paragraphs.
Ooh. Beautiful.
Yeah.
So, you know, spoiler alert, because this is the prologue.
Yeah.
They lose control of the hold.
Yeah. The hold gets lost as part of the abyssal eruption from Edge of the Abyss. And then the abyssal dwarves take it. The free dwarves are pushed back to be in Golic's empire. And right at the beginning of this book, the dwarves, the free dwarves are starting to invade back into Halpi.
They're trying to reclaim what was lost.
Yep. So yeah, that's the story of this one clan. It's the first clan to go back to retake their home. So like dwarves, if you like abyssal dwarves, if you like Imperials, it's a pretty good book. And even if you don't, it's a pretty good book. This shit needs it. Right? Let's go. So.
All right. Wonderful. So let's take a quick break, and we'll be back in a moment with more content.
All right.
Do it.
Welcome back. So for our main topic section of this podcast, and you know, it has been a while, so a lot of this is focused on catching up and promoting Mike's exciting novel. We thought we would actually delve a little bit deeper into the new D&D stuff. And after finishing recording, I'm going to be picking up my copy of the new Player's Handbook. So I haven't had the chance to go through it yet. But John, we'd love to hear some more of your thoughts on it. And also like kind of what that process was like of having your son build his first true D&D character.
That sounds great. Mike, have you picked the book up yet?
I did. I like a lot of the changes. I know that the character creation, it's different.
It's different.
I don't think it's laid out particularly cleanly, but I do like what they did with it. There are some things that I really like. First thing I do is I looked at rangers, because rangers are traditionally
they're very bad.
And some of the stuff that you would have to like, they improved enough stuff where it still feels like a ranger, but it is more efficient. So like, for example, I think right now, if you want to put Hunter's Mark on something, it takes a spell slot, right? In order to do that in the old version. In the new version, you just do it.
It's
anything that was an auto include in the old version, you just do now.
Yeah.
Right. For some of the weaker or less efficient character types, right? I think that's actually really smart in the big scheme of things, right?
Yeah, I agree. A lot of the classes just do their thing more often. There's a little bit less choices to make. Although one of the classes I was disappointed that they didn't change more was the Warlock, because I think that two spell slot restriction has always been a real barrier for me to liking the Warlock class.
I agree. I mean, it's almost built around like kitschy superpower stuff with the packs and the abilities, as opposed to the flexibility of being able to cast a wide range of spells, you know?
Yeah. So I don't know. I think generally there are nice improvements. I didn't look through all the classes yet, but I mean, I'm playing a druid in my our campaign right now. So I built a druid using the new rules, and there's nice things like you're not locked into some selections permanently. You get to change them every time you take a long rest. So like druid, I'm a druid of the land. Means you choose a land type. And in the previous edition, there were 8 types, but it was a permanent selection. Now there's only 4 types, but you get to change it on any, and it determines which spells you have access to. And So there's things like that, which I think are pretty nice, just quality of life changes to make it a little bit less damning if you make a choice that you decide you don't like later, and the character's a little bit more flexible.
Right.
I think that's you know, a trend towards making the game just more playable and less of a simulation, right? Like, yeah. Does it, like, what does it matter if I want to change my selections? So you're like imposing a penalty on me, what, because it's against the rules? Well, it's not fun if I don't like my selections.
Right. So, right. Exactly. So, but we've yeah. discussed this in the past too. The difference between this, to your point, being a tactical sim and you're trying to balance the characters, right, and their abilities, versus having it be story driven, right, where
right.
cool characters do cool stuff and the decisions you make matter, right? That really is what good D&D is. You yes. know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure.
So I haven't got through the whole book yet. I think I'll be reading through it. I have mm-hmm. some thoughts on the earlier sections. I have built a couple of characters. I have some thoughts on the character creation process, but I think you were specifically asking about maybe a very unique experience,
yeah.
which was starting the game with your kids for the first time.
Right.
So I alluded to it a little bit earlier, right, that I have been playing RPGs with my kids probably this year, like this calendar year. I think we started mm-hmm. over the winter. But I felt like starting with D&D was going to be too much. And my kids, they're 8 and 10, by the way, 10 years old. Right. So they love playing pretend, generally. And I thought, mm-hmm. well, maybe they like an RPG game where there's this kind of story component to it. And sure enough, they love it. And the game we're playing right now, I was able to buy like a PDF, like adventure pack. And the adventures take like, I think it's like between 1 and 2 hours to play through. And it's usually set up around like 6 to 9 encounters. And each encounter is either a social encounter or an exploration encounter or a combat encounter. Very, you know, mm-hmm. D&D centric. But they're pretty simple, right? Like you just, you know, an attack roll is just you roll like the enemy's defense versus the attacker's offense. And if you beat the defense die, they take a damage, right? And there's no hit points. You can get hit 3 times before you get knocked out. Like everything is right. very, very streamlined. But there's still that sense of like, you walk into a room, here's the description of the room and what you see, and then you have an opportunity to interact a little bit and play it out. So it's super streamlined, but it has the meat of kind of what the RPG games are like in there.
Right. And so when you were running that with them, they're totally down with it, as opposed to like the free play of just playing pretend, right? So that all of D&D in the big scheme of things, like pretend
there's some
with
structure to this,
you know what I mean? Structure or, but some could see it as restrictions, right? You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's true. No, they haven't had any problem with that. I think they really enjoy that there's a narrator that's driving the story. And so it's not just them playing pretend and whatever they want happens. There's some, I think they enjoy that there's a little bit of structure to it.
Sure.
Right. And they get to hear a story.
They get to hear a story too, yeah. right? And they're like, you know, there's a setting about this town that they're in, and it's nestled in this little quiet vale, and it would just be perfect there if it weren't for all these endless perils that beset the town. And the kids are like the heroes, and the grown-ups have to ask them to go solve problems and stuff like that.
Super awesome.
In the adventure last night that we were playing, called The Glade of the Unicorn, there's an injured unicorn, and they have to save the forest. And my son, who is playing like a warlock character that would shoot a flaming attack. Now he's got this brute guy that just hits people and knocks him down. And he was chasing the evil goblin leader. And so we're in the courtyard and we're fighting these goblins. And he's like, the goblin leader runs away. And he says, I'm going to go chase him. And the rest of his party is like, no, we have to like clean up the rest of his mess in the courtyard. And he's like, nope, I'm going into the dungeon by myself and chasing this guy. So he goes to the dungeon against the party's advice, gets completely overwhelmed, knocked out. Then the rest of the party, which is my wife and daughter, have to, you know, clean up the mess outside, heal up, deal with some things, then get in there, then save him. And so there was some tension last night over, you know, splitting the party and working together as a team. And it was excellent.
That's awesome. Right.
Yeah.
You're like, all right, you abandoned the party and got knocked out. After the game's over, you have to do the chores.
Yeah.
You clean up from dinner. That's the
Yeah. Yeah.
So you sat down with with Tony now, and you're like, okay, so here comes the new D&D book. Let's make a character in this new, using this new rule set, right? How does he come to what class he's going to do? What species? Like, how in his brain? Like, walk me through how that was. Did you guide him along that, or was he like, this is the cool dude I want to play? He's big. He punches, you know, people is what he does. Like how was it him driving the bus, or were you guiding him through the process?
He was driving the bus, but you know, if you walk around my house, there's D&D books lying around the coffee tables and on the bookshelves. And this year he's got a Dungeons and Dragons desk calendar, like a daily desk calendar. And so every day there's a picture of some type of monster or class or whatever. So he's getting very exposed to this Faerun or Dungeons and Dragons mindset. So he came into it and he has been reading my fourth edition rule book a little bit. Fifth edition, the 2014 version rule book. So he kind of had an idea about what the classes were, but they're different now. And so, you know, we sat down and I said, like, here's the steps. Like, and the new book does a pretty good job of laying out, like, these are the 7 steps you're going to take to build a character. I don't think from there it's laid out particularly well, but that's whatever. It's an aside. Sure. But it does give you a step-by-step. And so we just talk through it. Like, look, you're going to select a class, you're going to select a species, you're going to select your abilities, and I'll help you find these things in the book, and we could talk about them, what the implications are, but I want you to make the selections. And so, you know, he flipped through the pages, looked through all the classes, and then decided, I want a character that's kind of like the character I'm playing in Hero Kids. So, oh, okay, that makes sense. You know, you're kind of we're kind of replacing that game. So
yeah,
wants to go carry with it over. You know. Yeah. So he said, I'm looking for somebody that hits them. I said, oh, you probably want a fighter or a barbarian. But we looked at them all anyway, the monk, the rogue. It's okay. I want to be a barbarian. And then I just started walking him through the things. Like, he had no clue what stats were, you know, what is wisdom versus constitution versus dexterity. Yeah. And I explained a little bit about what they mean. I still don't think he entirely got it, but that's okay. You know, do you want to be trained in animal handling or do you want to be trained in survival? And he says, well, what's a skill proficiency though? I don't know what that word means.
Right.
I mean, it took hours to make the character, right? But it was just a matter of walking through all the, some of it was rules explanation. Some of it was, what's the story or the theme around this selection you're making? Like, why would you choose this versus the other thing? And I let him drive it. I said, you take whatever you want. I'll give you a suggestion if you aren't sure. But otherwise, I'm just going to let you pick whatever you want.
Nice. Right. And so in the end, he went with a barbarian.
An orc barbarian.
Ooh, so hits things very hard.
Hits things very hard. Had a little bit of trouble coming up with a name, so we had to go use some older materials to find like some name suggestions.
Name generators. Right.
Just some samples. Like, the new book doesn't contain anything about like these are what orc names sound like.
Right.
So we wanted to hit things. I had him write out all of the rules on the character sheet.
Nice.
Which was, again, partially a like penmanship exercise, but also a I just want you to write this down so there's a reminder that you don't have to write out the whole page of text about what rage means, but you need to know that you have 2 rages per day and have a way to track it and just kind of have like a general sense of my character can get angry. We can always go back and reference that rule, but you need a reminder that you have this thing.
Right. That is interesting. So he made the character, but he hasn't really played the new D&D yet, has he?
Like, he hasn't.
Sat down with you and
No, we got through his character before we played the RPG last night, but the other my wife and daughter hadn't made their characters yet, so we weren't quite ready to switch over. But my plan is to play through the remainder of those Hero Kids adventures and just substitute in their characters. And one of the things I like about D&D from this perspective is it does give you a little bit more of a framework. Like, the stripped down kids version of it, I notice this with them sometimes, because it doesn't have a lot of rules, it also doesn't exactly suggest to you what the possibilities are. Like,
right.
And that can be good and bad. Like, you look at a D&D character sheet and you have, what, about 20 skills or something like that? Mm-hmm. And they sometimes can be a little bit restrictive, especially if you're like, you're the kind of character that says, well, I'm going to roll survival to see what's what here. Like, well, what does that mean to you? What are you doing to use your survival skill? That would be my question as a DM. Different DMs play that differently. but at least it has a skill list to say you walk into a wizard's tower and you don't know what's going on. Well, what types of skills might be useful to me? In the lightweight RPG, there's only like maybe four, right? It's like investigation, right. Athletics. I can't remember them all offhand, but it's really, really streamlined. But that doesn't necessarily, for a kid who's learning what it means to role play within a structured game scenario, that what if, what could I possibly do?
Right.
Don't really know. So having some suggestions helps.
I totally see that. It's funny because a lot of it has to do with not quote unquote how your brain works, but there is a certain amount of like, are you, it's almost constitutional, are you a strict constructionist? Right. So if the, you know, if the rules say I can't do it, then I can do all these things and the brain works to fill in all the empty space.
Yeah.
Or the other way around, where it's like the rules say I can do this, you fill up to the, you know, to the shape of the vessel that you have. You know what
right.
I mean?
Right. Yeah. Right. People take different approaches to that. And neither are necessarily wrong, but they're different.
They certainly are, right? It's just a question of your relationship with the structure. I'm super excited to hear like how it goes as they graduate up to the next, you know, the next set of rules, right? Because there is a jump in complexity, which may or may not go over really well. I would imagine it's actually for your kids, it's going to be great, right? I mean, you guys game as a family.
That's which, what I was worried you know. About was that the jump of complexity would be challenging, but I plan to, you know, as best as I can kind of gauge how that's going and then just adjust my interactions in the game to take it into account. Like if it's too much for them to look at that character sheet, I'm just going to start crossing stuff off, you know?
Yeah, right. It's funny. I ran D&D for my kids last year and the year before over both summers. And Ellie had no interest in doing it until all the other kids are doing it. And then she sat down and I made a character for her. I said, what do you want to do? She goes, I want to sneak around. And I say, you want to sneak around and do what? What about there's like, you know, anyway, so we talked about it. She landed on being a rogue. And so I set her up with, and I gave her, instead of giving her all the suite of options, I was like, here's your stats. Don't worry about them. Here are the things you can do. You can attack, you can sneak, you can do this. You can throw a dagger. You can investigate, you can search. I gave her like 7-8 things with the bonus number to do it.
Oh, okay.
And that was it. Like that was, here you go. You're going to roll a D20. You're going to add that number. You're going to try to hit the target number. These are your options. And she loved it. She got done with the first game and she was like, that was so much fun. I want to play this again. I was like, sweet. Then that's we awesome. Will. Like not a problem. Right.
Right.
She's not in a position. I just want to contrast this because it's actually weird. She at her school out in Connecticut, there is no gaming club at her school. Right. And so just for some reason, like no one's talking about the Dungeons and Dragons that they play. So even if she wanted to play out there, she doesn't know how to like find a group and
get find into a group. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
In contrast, I'm at a work conference and Thursday night, we're all, a bunch of us are out at dinner. And I asked the guy next to me, this, you know, GIS expert from North Dakota. I was like, so what do you do when you're not working on a computer? He goes, well, you know, I like to do something or other. And then he goes, oh, and I play Dungeons and Dragons. I go, yeah. He goes, oh yeah. I've been playing every week with like some buddies of mine for about 7-8 years now. I'm like, oh yeah. Right. And so we're talking and this guy at the end of the table, gray haired bro, is like, oh, you guys talking Dungeons and Dragons? I'm like, yeah. He goes, oh, I play that with my kid. I'm like, crap, man. How old is your kid? I'm expecting to say like 10. He's like, no, my kid's like 23. Like, so I play with him and his friends. How different is the world? Right.
Right.
You know what I mean? How different is the world? This is amazing to me. Right. I mean, I lived in a satanic panic and this is what's going on. You know, now everybody's just like, yeah, of course I do structured storytelling and in a fantasy setting with my friends.
Right.
Okay. Well,
right.
Of course you do. Right. Ridiculous.
Yeah. Right.
There is, it's interesting because obviously my daughter is not old enough for any of this stuff yet.
Right.
I do work in a school that is middle and high school. So grade 6 through 12.
Sure.
And we do have a couple of my friends who work there run the Dungeons and Dragons Club after school for students. But even like it's so much more a part of like the popular culture and most people know. And I think part of that is due to the success of Stranger Things and how Dungeons and Dragons is like a recurring theme in that show. But like all the kids know who what it is, and I've had kids like every year, like they don't know right out the gate that I am a gamer, but I'll hear them like I'll see, oh, you're carrying around the Player's Handbook, oh, you're carrying around like Dungeon of the Mad Mate, like so there's always something. And I've had kids a couple times be like, hey, we're trying to play our campaign during lunch, but the cafeteria is loud, can we sit in your room and play? I'm like, yeah, obviously.
Yeah, please.
Here's a pass. But it's funny because people I know who are not gamers, when they're like, oh, you're going to like a tournament weekend, I'm like, yeah. They're like, oh yeah, so you're going to play Dungeons & Dragons for the weekend. I'm just like, yeah. Like they don't know just, what miniature wargaming is, but
right.
So they just call any of it Dungeons and Dragons.
Right.
That's like,
it's funny.
Oh, you're doing your Dungeons and Dragons this weekend in New York? I'm like, yeah, that. Yep.
Sure. Let's go with that. Right. Everyone I talk to, when I say I'm doing a tournament, they automatically assume I'm doing a karate tournament.
Oh,
right. Because they know I do martial arts. Like, oh yeah. So you doing kata? You're doing sparring? I'm like, I'm doing neither, buddy. Let me explain to you what I do. Right. And then that gets huge amounts of interest too. Right, which is weird to me. You know, I still have the hangover of being like, yes, I paint little dudes like the 40-year-old virgin. But like, no one looks down on me for that. Like, oh, yeah, show me. I'm like, okay, then I will. Right, here's some pictures. They're dwarves.
It is so much more accessible. And, you know, I think there's other things. Stranger Things was wildly popular, obviously. But there's video games, too. Like the Warhammer Total War game was incredibly popular. Mm-hmm. The new Space Marine video game just came out. I don't know, like last week or something, and that's been incredibly popular. So
there's appeal to people who like video games but haven't seen these other sides of the hobby, who are getting exposure to it through that. Yeah,
totally true. Cool, man. So I'm super excited. I'm just I think it's cool. I mean, we brought this up a couple times, mostly because we're parents and kids that are different ages, but just you want to give them all the joy that you have with the stuff that you do. And hope that they find joy in it too, right? And every once in a while, I think gaming is hyper accessible now for kids.
Yeah, I'm totally fine if they don't. Like, if that's not the thing that they want to do, then I'm not, you know, I'm not going to, like, force them to play or anything. I hope they enjoy it, but I want them to have fun. And if I just want to have that, like you said, that exposure, I guess, so they have the opportunity. Like, it's not something my, you know, I don't know, in a different world, my wife wouldn't expose them to it, right? Like, that's going to come through me.
Right, right.
And it's fun. I mean, like I have like a little gamer buddy in the house now. It's awesome.
Yeah,
we could talk. You know, we get in the car to go somewhere, and we're talking about like playing 40K or Dungeons & Dragons or whatever. It's great.
It's awesome. I think that point you made is a really good one, John. That like you want to give your kids exposure to as many possible hobbies or activities they might be interested in as possible, because they don't know what they like if they don't know it exists, right?
Right.
And you don't want to force them towards anything, but surely like when you're passionate and enthusiastic about something, like young people feed off of that. So yeah, just like, you know, a world when we were growing up, it wasn't our parents. I mean, Jake has talked about how he played D&D with his dad, but like when we grew up, our parents weren't the ones who got us into gaming. Like, I just happened to know somebody who had like known, like it was so much harder to, but now it's like, if we do our job correctly, our kids are going to know about all sorts of things and can pick from there what they like and what they want to do.
Well, also with my kids, with this stuff in particular, like they don't have any exposure to the internet. So there's no way they're going to discover the stuff on their own, not at this age, at least. So I've got to expose them to that if they're going to make that choice.
Right.
If they're interested in something.
Yeah. But that's cool though.
It's been super fun. I mean, like I said, it's been fun. It's been rewarding to be able to spend that time with the kids. And my daughter loves playing. She's less into like the rules bit of it. So like when we talk about even character creation, she's not going to be too into that, but she'll sit down and play and have a great time. Whereas my son is really going to like dig in through the book and look at all the options and go create, you know, what if character scenarios and stuff. And
right.
it's kind of like the person who's like, yeah, I mean, it's different. We've seen that before, right? Like, there's a person who's happy to play, and then there's a person who's into it.
Yeah, right. If everything's laid out for them and you grease all the skids, then they're totally cool.
Right.
Right? As opposed to others that are, seeking it out, and it takes up that brain space, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the difference.
Awesome.
So, right. So Mike, your experience with Ellie, though, has Ellie been back to it again and again, or it's been like once in a while thing?
Well, yeah, once in a while. Just, once, you know, because it's if I'm running it here and, you know, for the kids, and if she's here on the weekend when I'm doing it, then she will gladly play.
Gotcha.
Right?
Yep.
But, you know, I think when she went home and she couldn't find a group readily available, she's like, meh, meh, meh. And then, you know, she's also at that weird age where it's hard to, hey, I'm confident enough where I can go and find a group of other people to do something, as opposed to sitting around waiting to be judged, found worthy, right? Yeah. By your peers. It's a different thing, right? In some ways, she's one hell of a leader, and doesn't care much about the opinions of others when she feels that she's right. But on the other side, she is really looking for validation, like all teenagers are, right?
Yeah, totally.
Peer group, you know? Totally. So, you know, you don't want to go to the wrong person and say, hey, do you do D&D, and then be judged, right? Or put into a box. Oh, so you must be one of, quote unquote, those types of kids, right? So she's, you know, we talked about it a little bit, and I'm like, well, you got to find your tribe, sweetie. And I don't know how else to tell you what to do, you know? And, you know, I mean, I think things get a lot easier in college, one, because there's a much bigger group of people. There's more varied experiences, and it's easier in a giant crowd to find your people, right? Because there's more people to find.
I also think you care less as you get older.
I think so. I think it's part of it too. Right. But because it comes from like frontal lobe development and increasing confidence. Right.
Right.
But anywho. Cool. So yeah, awesome. I'm super glad for you, man. That rules.
Yeah.
And no, I'm excited for what this new version of D&D is going to bring. I think it's going to be a little more streamlined. You know, right now we're doing on the current campaign that we're doing, that Kyle is running, we're doing Pathfinder.
Right.
And Pathfinder, I am finding, is complex for the point of being complex. And it detracts from, in my opinion, it detracts from the storytelling. I think there's some good stuff in it. But I don't think it's as an entire rule set. I actually find that I like the simplicity of D&D if the group is willing to fill in all the holes. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, right? That what you get out of these experiences is, depending on, I'm going to say that awkwardly, you get, like, you have to understand what you want to get out of it as an experience.
Right, right. Cool. All right. So I think in the time we have left, we have one more topic we want to cover. And this one is actually really near and dear to my heart, because if you guys know, I run a tournament, the Dead of Winter tournament, up in Albany, and charity. You know, there's a charity raffle that we've been able to raise a bunch of money on, and a lot of other events in the Mid-Atlantic, in the Northeast, and in the South too. Put a lot of emphasis on charity work, leveraging the great community we have, right, to help the world at large. And Crossroads, I think, is going to be no different. Greg is going to be running a charity event. And I think I want to hear more about it.
Yeah, thanks. So I'm really excited about this event. I look forward to Crossroads every year, and I'm definitely excited to play in the team tournament. But the side event that I'm running for charity, I think, is, like, if I had to pick, I could go and only do one of the two. I'd do the side event. Like, I really... think I created something fun and interesting, and hopefully it's going to raise a decent amount of money in the process. So just a little background on this. Final 2 years that we ran Unplugged GT, which is currently on hiatus. I'm not saying it's gone forever. I'm also not saying it's coming back immediately. Well, yet to be seen. But the last two times we ran it, I added a charity component. And I really wanted to continue that, but didn't have like a home GT or like my own GT to do it out of. Yeah. So I talked to Corey, and I think Crossroads is the right spot for it, because one, it just brings in a ton of people.
we got like 90 something players for the Kings of War team tournament. There's going to be some other folks there playing a Mordheim campaign. So there's a lot of people around. And when I started going to Crossroads back in Warhammer Fantasy days, and I'm sure John and Mike, y'all remember this too, there used to be side events, usually on Friday night, sometimes on Saturday night, that were like Warhammer Fantasy related, but were not like playing in the tournament. Like I remember there being like a chariot race one year,
yeah,
that somebody organized, and there was like a cage match for your heroes one year, like just kind of fun, like out of the box stuff that you don't normally get to do, but you have all these people together who play this game, so why not do something interesting? So I tried to combine my interest in running a charity event with my interest in running something a little more wacky or just more for fun with the group that's there. So the way this is going to work, it's open to anybody. And all you need to do to show up is take a look at the player pack and follow the rules I put in there to create your own rare monster. So again, this comes from the Kings of War rulebook, the Big Red rulebook. There's rules in there for monster creation. I've added some stipulations to what's in there because some of it I thought was a little unbalanced. And when I explain the way this event works, you'll see why I chose to just delete some options that don't make sense, you don't need. But essentially, you make your own monster, 225 total points you have to play with. So you can make something that's pretty decent, but it's not going to be like... You definitely have to choose how to invest your points. You can you can go all out offensively, you could go all out defensively, or you can find a nice balance in the middle, right? And so everyone who creates their monster, you pay 10 bucks to enter. I'll talk about where this money is going at the end, but you pay 10 bucks to enter. And you put your monster into a time trial event that I will run individually with each participant. And you can come up and we can do this on Friday night. We could do it on Saturday night. Either way, it doesn't matter. You could coordinate with me in advance when you want to come and do it, or I'm going to be set up. I'll have a station. Everything's ready to go. You can just walk up when it's open. So you've got your monster. You put it on the table. I've got a deck of cards that have 20 different enemies that you might face. Okay. And you're going to pick a card off the top. And this is all the stuff I'm about to kind of explain is secret, but I'll give a couple of previews. So anyone, I'm going to try and get this posted before Crossroads. So anyone who's listening to this, you maybe get a little bit of a heads up. So there's 20 different options. Whatever you pull, you're going to face. Okay. One of those options is a troop of berserkers, right? Okay. So I put my troop of berserkers down. You put your monster down. 5 minutes on the timer. Go. We start to fight. There's no like charging or anything like that. It's just whoever has the further range, it gets to swing first. And I do have some rules in there for if you have a ranged weapon, if and when you get to use it. You might get to use it. You just see in the pack. But you just alternate going back and forth until you know, one side has been routed. Assuming that your monster is victorious against the troop of berserkers, whoever it is, you pause the timer. Your rare monster heals half of its damage rounded up. You pull another card and you fight again. Okay. And you have 5 minutes. So the goal is to accumulate as many points as you can in those 5 minutes. Obviously, if you get routed, you know, that limits how many things you could kill. There are bonuses baked into this that you can earn bonus points for meeting certain qualifications. But then also, because I am trying to raise money and because this is going to be difficult, I have a menu of advantages that you can purchase after you've revealed your enemy, but before I start the timer. And there are 8 advantages. They range in cost from $1 to $3, depending on how powerful they are. And each one can only be purchased one time, and you can only purchase one for each round. So you can't, like, buy them all at once, for example. Sure. And again, these are secret, but as an example, I'll give you one. One of them is you get access to Banechant 2 for $1. So for that entire round, let's say you were fighting the Berserkers, before you roll your attacks, each time you can cast Bane Chant 2 on yourself. So it's not guaranteed to go off, but you know, you should, the majority of the time, you should get it, right? And so you have that to try and give you the edge. And so I'll do that with as many people as I can get to come and enter. Hopefully the more the merrier, right?
Yeah.
At the end of it, because I'm going to keep a leaderboard that'll be running, it'll be on display next to where we're doing the event. At the end of Saturday night, when everyone who's wanted to enter the time trial has done it, the two players who got the highest scores, accumulated the most points, they're going to face off in a cage match on Sunday to determine the winner. And so this will be held at the conclusion of the tournament, but before we do the awards. And I'll have the two of them come up and face off against each other. Very similar format to when you're facing the deck of enemies, except it's player versus player. Okay. And I'm going to, you know, Corey always has a sound system set up with a microphone. So I'm going to be there narrating it like it's a freaking boxing match, right? This is the title fight. And there will be a menu of advantages. However, for the cage match, the advantages are much more expensive. They range in price from $5 to $20. Okay. But the participants are not the ones who buy it. It is the audience members, the spectator. So again, secret, but I'll give you an example of one. This one is my favorite. So it's not necessarily the most powerful, but it is my favorite. So for $15 in the cage match, one spectator or a group of spectators can come together and collectively raise the funds. For $15, they can purchase Blood of the Old King. And for that one turn, the rare monster gains elite and vicious, but it is Blood of the Old King. So for each die rolled, re-rolled, the rare monster receives an immediate point of damage. So,
so you can do it either because you want them to win or to lose.
Or because you want them to lose.
That's it.
That's awesome.
Oh, that is great. That is great.
So yeah, that's the way it's going to run.
I like it.
I'm really excited. I have heard from a handful of folks already who've told me they're planning on coming. I've had some people reach out and share the monster that they've created so I could take a look at it in advance. I did hear from one person, which was Harry, that he actually was looking forward to this so much, he painted a new model specially for it.
Nice.
Which is really nice. So obviously I'm hoping that it's a success. I'm really looking forward to seeing how it plays out. There is... You know, I've done kind of stuff like this. I've made a narrative campaign. I've done, I did a tournament, a special tournament that, John, you were at where, like, everybody could have a rare monster. I like when I have come up with a different way to play the game, watching people play it out and see how it goes. Right? It's like another side of this hobby that you don't always get to enjoy. So I'm looking forward to that. And again, I'm hoping we raise a lot of money. And so all the money that is being raised for this event is going to go to UNICEF, which, if you're unfamiliar with them, UNICEF is a branch of the United Nations that does work for children and infants. And they, according to their website, are on the ground in 190 countries and territories around the world, providing children with life-saving supplies and assistance they desperately need. Across a wide variety, whether that's like nutrition or other health necessities, education, protection from violence, etc. So they do really important work. I want to show as a community what we can do, what we're capable of by raising a lot of money and sending it to a very important cause. So,
right.
That's my pitch.
That is awesome.
Sounds really exciting, Craig.
Yeah, it does.
Sad, I'm going to miss it. That's so fun. Right?
Yeah. Totally and, rules. You know, if it goes well and people enjoy participating in it, it's set up to be a thing where, you know, we could run it every year. Obviously, changes could be made, adjustments could be made here and there, but I'm hoping to make it a tradition if it is something that people really respond well with. So. I'll let you know. I'm going to take a bunch of pictures of everybody, you know, during the event. So I'll show off all the monsters that people bring. I'm bringing a crazy amount of miniatures from my own collection because all the enemies are coming from the stuff that I own across multiple different armies.
Right.
Yeah, it's going to be a good time. And
that rules.
Yeah. I'll let you know afterwards. Hopefully you're there to participate. If you're not, you'll be able to follow along the action, lots of pictures, and we'll talk all about it on our next episode.
Awesome.
Yeah, dude. Super happy. Right. I mean, just out of all the events in the Northeast, I think we've raised, what did we raise last year amongst everyone? We raised almost $4,000 for various charities, right? The year before that, I think we were around 4,500, 5,000. Like we're,
yeah, that's impressive.
We're sick. Yeah. I mean, amazing. It really is.
And this impressive. Isn't even, I mean, Corey does his own charity raffle at Crossroads. Yeah, so absolutely. There is like, this isn't even the only thing. And I really wanted to design something that wouldn't, that could coexist well with what Corey's already doing and not like compete against each other.
Right.
So yeah.
No, that's awesome. Cool. All right.
So, all right, gentlemen. Yeah. Well, it's been a real treat to get back on the microphone and talk to you all. This is a long time coming, and I'm glad we got all the technical hurdles cleared so that we could, you know, have a feed, we could have it actually posting live to all the places we want, and we could coordinate our schedules,
which is getting harder and harder.
That's the hardest
which
part,
is getting harder and harder to find you know, an hour or two to sit down and chat,
right? But it's funny because I think this is going to be our number. This is number 100, right? And
yes.
a lot of other podcasts would sit down and go, okay, we're going to make it an extravaganza. And we're going to get all kinds of people talking about how great we are. We're going to go out the street and get interviews. And none of that happened because it was just a miracle to go from John sending us a text going, all of our content is missing, and me going, what? And then from that to being able to get everything rebuilt and up and running now, I'm just happy to be here, man. I mean, which kind of,
yeah,
in any competitive Kings of War thing, I think that's the same thing. I'm just happy to be there. But like, it's totally is a feat for us to refigure everything out, get things started again. I would imagine one of these times, maybe episode 111, maybe we'll do some sort of self-congratulatory thing. But for now, right, I'll just
111th birthday.
That's right. Exactly. It's my 111th first birthday. That's how you do it, right? So, no, that's the, I'm just so happy.
Anyway. Yeah, be happy we're here. Yep.
Right. All right.
Good stuff. All right, guys.
All right, buddies.
Great chatting with you.
Be well.
Yeah, dude. All right. See you. Well. Later.
Thanks for joining us. We hope you like what you heard.
If you have any thoughts about the episode, please find us on Facebook and leave us some feedback. And if the spirit moves you, leave us a review on iTunes and work that algorithm.
Special thanks to Robbie P. and the Countercharge Podcast Network for hosting us. And to all you listeners, y'all are awesome.